There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings together the best bits of today's show from Tuesday, November the 12th.
The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
Right, we had questions, so we have brought in a man to answer them. Richard's pick of the papers is interrogating Mohammed Salman.
Exactly, Mohammed. Good to have you with us. I know you've been speaking to a number of the people from the RTA about this.
I have indeed. So we know that from December 7th, we will no longer be able to book a taxi over the phone. Now, I'll be honest, I'm one of the people guilty of this. I have not downloaded the Hala app yet. Whenever I do want to call a taxi or hail a taxi, I do it over the phone. So I will be one of the
You're a millennial. You're almost Gen Z.
You know, it's one of those things where I always say that next time I'm going to download the app, but I've just never gotten around to doing it. But from what I've heard and from the people that I've been speaking to, it's extremely easy. So the app is called Hala, which is H-A-L-A. You download it, you put in your details, and it's supposed to be very, very easy to do, hail a taxi. And the other thing they're saying is that the waiting time for a taxi will be much less now. So they're saying that 3.5 minutes on average versus 11 minutes through the call center.
Ah, you see, this is I did not know that there was an actual Hala app.
Yes.
Because I've just got the Kareem app, and there's a button in there. Do you want a Lexus or do you want a helicopter?
Yeah.
Or do you want...
Can you book a helicopter?
There's a button that says helicopter.
You've never pressed it.
See what happens, Rich. Go on, do it now.
But...
While Rich is getting his head around the app, you've been speaking to Ahmed Barozian, right?
Yes.
Who is the CEO of RTA's public transport agency. Back in August this year when they launched the service, and I believe you asked him then about the future of call centres. This is what he said.
Yes, so we will eventually be phasing it out, but we will be doing it in a very careful way. We understand that a lot of people are used to calling the call center for dispatching. We will, as those people start calling us, we will start encouraging them to download the Kareem app and order taxis through the app, and we'll be doing that by explaining to them what the benefits of calling through the app are versus the traditional call center. We will not, of course, abruptly be bringing the call center service to an end, because there are people who will still be more comfortable talking to an agent, but we hope that over time, organically and naturally, more and more people will be ordering through the app, and hopefully, eventually, as we have, you know, pretty much most people comfortable with the app, we will then be phasing out the call center.
Clearly, they think people are, because that was August, and now we're coming into December and it's happening.
Just a few months since he made those comments, but he did mention that there are added benefits of using the app versus using a call center. So some of those benefits that they have mentioned is visible before the car arrives. So you can basically track where your taxi driver is, which is obviously very useful. There's also going to be an in-app chat function. So if you want to chat with, like a live chat to find out where your taxi is or any specifications or what kind of taxi you want to order, you can do that as well. You can also rate your driver. So this is obviously very Uber-like as well. And you can also tip them through the app as well. So those who are in the habit of tipping taxi drivers, you can do it through the app.
Do you pay by cash still, or is it credit card?
You can do both. You can do both, yeah. You can also do it directly through the app as well. So
handy if you don't have cash on you, and there's that whole struggle for change. I don't have change. I'm sorry, I don't have change. You
exactly.
Pull up outside a shop, you run and you try and get change. Yeah. We've been wondering, and our big question is, Mohammed, what does this mean for people who either aren't very smartphone savvy? My mum doesn't have one, for example. Refuses to have one. She's been bought about six. I just throw that out there. People who are on holiday who don't necessarily have the data. I know they get given other chips at the airport, but if you've used it up. Or even people here, because a lot of people have either no or low data plans, don't they? And people just sort of Wi-Fi jump around the place.
That's right. I'm sure there will be people who will be... I guess they don't have an option but to call a taxi over the phone, right? So we haven't heard anything from the RTA yet about how these people will be catered to, but this is something that we will be putting forth to them and finding out how someone can book a taxi if they don't have access to either data or their smartphone.
What about the psychology of tipping? I always feel if I'm face to face with a driver that I would tip him more than I would on an app necessarily when you're not face to face. And I wonder whether drivers are going to get less tips than they are at the moment once it's all done via the app. Oh, yeah, I'll tip you on the app, and yet you don't get round to it afterwards.
I think I'm in the same boat as Malcolm on this one. I think there's something special about a physical tip.
Giving somebody 5 or 10 dirhams.
And I think most people do prefer to do that rather than do it through the app.
Nothing to stop you doing that in person, though, is there?
Of course not, yeah. You can still pay the taxi fare on the app and then give a 5 or 10 dirham tip.
Well, I still do, but I'm wondering whether the general sort of feeling would be, well, I'll do it on the app, and then actually when you get home, you never get around to
just
putting it on again.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Not necessarily because you want to, but just you forget. You
know? Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Well, we look forward to hearing from you when you've found out more, Mohammed Suleiman, but thank you for coming and updating us what's happening with the Hala app.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We've been having a look at the rise and the rise and the rise of short-term rentals. As someone who has just gone through the rental process again, went and got my Ajari yesterday for my new flat, there's a lot of stock out there and the prices are really great if you're a tenant at the moment. But obviously, for every tenant, there needs to be a landlord. And for a lot of landlords, people who've got mortgages, people who are paying service fees, they're looking at the reduced rents. And some of them are thinking, maybe I don't want a long-term tenant after all. Maybe I would do better playing in the Airbnb market. We've been speaking this morning to Reem Al-Khatib, Managing Director for the UAE at Guest Ready. They are one of those global management companies that will basically take your flat, if it's pretty enough and in the right place, and they will put it not just on Airbnb, but you know, some of the other platforms as well. What else is there out there? One Fine Stay, there's a bunch of them. And we were asking Reem this morning, because they've just had a bit of a milestone themselves, actually. They've just, in the last sort of 2 days, crossed the $1 billion worth of assets that they are managing. We've asked them what kind of growth rate they're seeing here in the UAE when it comes to people coming to them to rent out their properties.
Obviously, the hardest thing would be in the very beginning. We're still trying to build a reputation here. But then after a few months, now in Dubai, we can't even keep up anymore. We have more than, we're onboarding around 10 properties, 20 properties a month. So there's definitely a lot of demand there. Also, with Expo 2020 coming up, there's more and more homeowners that are looking to turn their properties into holiday homes to benefit from this flexibility. So I would say Dubai regulates, the DCM regulating authority in Dubai has really helped us with this. They're making it much easier for property investors to have more confidence in this type of agreement with tenants.
Interesting, obviously, that she talks about both regulation and confidence, because one of the big furores of this year was with EMA and owners in the downtown area about whether or not they could do their own short-term letting. And we asked her whether it was putting people off the sector.
I think in the beginning, we did get a lot of investors telling us that this is a bit demotivating. They did consider not investing, and some people did stop certain investments from going through. But I think in the end, as I said, also the regulating authority went back and did protect these investor rights. So I think maybe they, even if they were shook a little bit, they did end up through DCM and through the Dubai government and increase the confidence in the market.
And that is Reem Al-Khatib, Managing Director for the UAE at Guest Ready.
Talking happiness this morning, I was down yesterday, as you know, in Sharjah at the Foreign Direct Investment Forum. And as you would expect, there were lots of economists talking about foreign direct investment and the economy and the fourth industrial revolution. What I didn't expect was a big focus on happiness. And that's because one of the keynote speakers, or the keynote speaker, was Mo Gordat, headed up Google X for over a decade. That's their moonshot, their research division. But what he wrote a book about was not how to become a tech guru, it was how to become happy, because he realized, despite all this success that he had and the money and the adulation, he wasn't very happy. He applied his Google mind to solving the problem. Now, we're going to hear that interview with him in about 6 or 7 minutes' time. But this morning, we've been speaking to a psychologist here in Dubai to get a bit of perspective on this, to kind of get some tips on how we can achieve happiness in the city, because we figured that there'd be quite a lot of people listening to a show like The Business Breakfast, driving to work, thinking, yep, I'm in a really nice car, good paycheck at the end of the month, and I've got a high status job, but am I really happy? Possibly not. We all know people like that. Farah Dahabi is a psychologist at the Lighthouse Arabia, and we asked her, what practical tips can you give people to achieve not just superficial happiness, but inner happiness?
When it comes to what adds happiness or wellness to our life, it's really important that we do not attach our worth to anything outside of ourselves, any kind of moving target. That means a certain position at work. It means the type of car that you drive or how much money you have in the bank. It really has to be deriving your worth from an inner sense of purpose and from within you.
That's Salat Hassel Rabea's Farah Dahabi. What if you got one word, what would make you happy? For me, fast car, plenty of money. Yes, that does it for some people. But then a golden retriever and plenty of time to walk the dog in would do it for others. So what for you guys is the key thing?
What makes me happy? Freedom, the ability to move around.
Freedom's a good choice.
I mean, I've always been quite a happy person. You had a nickname for me, what, over 10
Serotonin
years ago?
Boy.
Serotonin
boy.
Smiley.
Because I'm just a kind of happy person. I don't know. I love my life. I even like my work. I even like some of my colleagues.
So, some of them.
Could you be more specific?
No, so I feel blessed. I'm lucky. But I guess I'm lucky that I appreciate what I have and I enjoy it.
But I guess that time is not sort of valuable unless you've got enough money to do what you want to do in that time.
And those are the big things, aren't they? Do you know what I did find really interesting? Speaking of doing what you want to do, we're going to hear, as you said, your interview with the Google engineer, Mo Gaudet. His book is called...
Solve for Happy.
So I, yesterday on the radio, gleefully told everyone that I had the book and I read it, but I was lying.
Because he is not the only Google engineer to have written a book about happiness.
No, he's not. A guy called Chade-Meng Tang has written a book called Search Inside Yourself, which is all about sort of mindfulness and meditation and all the rest of it. I've got a copy of it. It's in my car, funnily enough. And that's the one that I have read. So is this like the new Google side hustle?
There are some smart people. And they think differently. So frankly, there are worse places to be churning out books about happiness.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Talking happiness now, because yesterday down at the Sharjah Foreign Direct Investment Forum, the keynote speaker was the former Google ex-boss Mo Gaudet, Egyptian guy, fascinating fella. Not really, though, talking about technology, talking about happiness. He's applied his Google engineeringness to solving the problem of happiness. Why are so many people successful yet unhappy? Including for a long time, him, and this is how he wants to change the world.
You know, I started my life with a lot of success and very little happiness, which is a story that's not unusual, actually. The more life blesses us, somehow we forget the blessings and just focus on the negative and feel very unhappy. And I had to find my way out of happiness through the language that I understand. They say that three of every four people in the modern world today prioritize their logic over their emotions. And so I needed to understand happiness from a logical place, like an engineer, if you want. I had my wonderful son who was a natural practitioner of happiness, you know, born happy, lived all his life, you know, in peace, contentment, almost like a tiny little Zen monk he was. And he helped me through my research by helping me restate what I understood from my logic using my heart. The second milestone, unfortunately, is when I lost my son. I lost him because of a medical malpractice in a very simple medical operation. And, of course, no one would have blamed me if I had spent the rest of my life grieving. But I recognized very quickly that this wouldn't bring him back. It wouldn't change a thing. And that maybe it would be better if I sort of shared what I learned from him with the world. In a very unusual way, I sort of gave myself a target. I said, if I can get 10 million people to know what he taught me and sort of find happiness as a result and maybe love him as much as I love him, then it wouldn't be for nothing that he left our world. And I started to write, and the universe helped out. I mean, within 6 weeks, we reached 10 million happy. And we've been now working as a small team on 1 billion happy people around the world as our mission for the last 2 years.
So tell us about the so-called algorithm that you developed for happiness. It sounds counterintuitive, but explain how that works.
Yeah, it's not at all. We're so predictable as humans. It's just that there are so many things happening that, you know, sometimes it appears that we're chaotic. We're not at all. If you look at any moment in your life where you ever felt happy, there is one common thread across them, which is, it doesn't actually relate at all to what was happening in your life. It relates to a comparison between what's happening and what you wanted life to be. If life meets your expectations, you're happy, and if it misses your expectations, you're unhappy. And you can, you know, easily say that in a mathematical equation. Mine is that happiness is equal to or greater than the difference between the events of your life and your expectations of how life should behave. So you take anything, you take an event like the rains yesterday, right? If you wanted rain because you needed to water your garden, you would feel very happy. If you want to, you know, if the rain made you get stuck on your commute, you would feel unhappy. Rain itself doesn't have any inherent happiness value to it. It's the comparison in your head that makes it a good thing or a bad thing. It makes you happy or unhappy. And so knowing that, you would start to define happiness very differently than what most people in the modern world do. Most people associate happiness with fun and luxury and buying expensive things and going on vacations. That's actually not true at all. You could be on the most exotic vacation in the world and your manager sends you an annoying email and that misses your expectations and you'll be miserable. So the answer to happiness really is to find that contentment, is to find the peace where you realize that the events of your life, believe it or not, if you're listening to this radio show, you're probably luckier than 90%, 95% of everyone who lives on our little planet today. So does that not constitute events that should meet your expectations? Or is that one thing missing, like your boss is annoying, should that make you unhappy? And I think that's really the question that we need to start asking ourselves a little more often.
Finally, you've set yourself the goal of making 1 billion people happy. And this, you explained, was something that you learned at Google X, solving big problems. And the benchmark is the solutions have to help at least 1 billion people. So explain how you came up with that philosophy at Google and how you applied it there. And then finally, how you're applying it to your happiness mission.
So Google in general and Google X in specific was never a business, if you want, a typical business. Larry and Sergey wrote that in the IPO letter, that they were not going to ever be a regular business. I felt in the 12 years I spent at Google that it was more of a movement, something that was attempting to really make a difference and change the world and made a lot of money as a result, if you want, right? So 1 billion people is actually not impossible on the internet. It's not a big target, believe it or not. You could probably, many successful businesses and apps and websites reach 1 billion people on a regular basis. And the idea here is to find a radical solution in my own personal mission to spread happiness. So you know, happiness has traditionally been spread through, if you want, the spiritual model, you know, practice and mystical talks and, you know, yoga and meditation and all of the contentment that religion would invite us to find and spirituality would invite us to find. And yes, that absolutely works. But to scale it, you need to add things like apps, you need to add things like platforms, and you need to add things like literally economics and mathematical calculations that allow you to spread the message in a way that's effective around the world. And there is a science to that. And so what I've been attempting to do with 1 Billion Happy is to not just write a good piece of literature or two or four books that, you know, that people can learn from, but actually spread those in the modern way, you know, through video content, through apps, and so on and so forth.
Lastly, what's one thing that people can do today, one step that they can take, people driving to work, that will make them happier?
I think the number one task for anyone who wants to be happy is to be honest with themselves and ask themselves if they actually make happiness their priority. Because if it's not your priority, it's never going to work. And you know, happiness is just like fitness. If you make fitness your priority and work out 4 to 5 times a week, you'll be fitter, right? It's really not rocket science. Now, of course, personal trainers will make it look like it's a very complex topic. So do shrinks and happiness practitioners or happiness teachers. I think happiness is very straightforward. If you're not making it your priority, why do you expect it to happen? You know, and if you make it a priority, you probably won't need me much. You know, I have all of my videos online, but there are, you know, hundreds of others, amazing, much better teachers of the topic than I am. And the content has been around forever. It's just a question of, are you making it your priority? Are you doing the things and making the decisions that are going to make you not only successful in life, but successful and happy?
That's Mel Gaudet, the former Google X boss, speaking to Richard Dean at the Sharjah FDI Forum.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Aviation issues abound at the moment, and two stories involving Qantas and British Airways particularly interesting at the moment. Joining us on the line is Vinamra Longani, head of operations at the aviation-related law firm Sarin & Co. Now, Qantas have vowed to have net zero carbon emissions by 2050 via carbon credits and the like. It's likely that hydrocarbon energy will still be powering planes in 2015. So, in 2050, rather, how is this going to work?
Well, there are some statistics that I'd like to run everyone through. I mean, to be honest, a lot has already been done to reduce the footprint of the average journey which is taken by a common man by air. So to be fair, the carbon footprint today of an average journey is half of what it was three decades ago. So, and commercial aviation is kind of responsible for about 2% of global carbon emissions. So Qantas and obviously British Airways, IAG, are leading the pack. And there are a couple of things that they plan on doing. One is obviously help develop a sustainable aviation fuel. So that is obviously a long-term solution. It's under development. And I mean, about 150,000 flights have already, used biofuels in some sort of way. So that's the big one. Qantas already uses, as much as they fly nonstop from Perth to London, and one does wonder, you know, for an airline that's flying 16, 17 hours, I mean, for them to turn around and say that, you know, we want to be net carbon neutral. But, you know, they do this on a brand new Boeing 787 Dreamliner, which is at least 20%, if not more, fuel efficient compared to their older jets.
Sorry to interrupt you there. I'm guessing that flying non-stop, though, it uses yet less fuel and emits less carbon than if you stop mid-route.
That is definitely one take on it, Malcolm. So, but when it does come to using biofuels, aviation is concentrated around hubs around the world, and it becomes a lot easier to distribute biofuel at a hub than for one to be able to distribute it at another airport. So, for example, Dubai, Emirates flies thousands of flights out of DXB. So if they were to lead the pack and have a huge biofuel facility available for the airline per se, it's a lot easier for them to be able to distribute that fuel at a hub. So there are obviously two sides to it, and I guess we'll just have to wait and see how this pans out in the future.
The airlines have not said, and we must, sorry, for credit where credit's due, we should put Air France up there as well as Qantas and British Airways, but they've said that they're going to be carbon neutral by 2050. Now, carbon credits exist at the moment, so why can't airlines join carbon offset programs today to become carbon neutral virtually immediately?
So the thing is, you know, there has to be a lot of education around this on the customer front as well. Carbon offset schemes are definitely available, and a lot of airlines have been doing this for a while. ICAO, I mean, one could honestly log on to ICAO's website and calculate their own carbon footprint on a journey and then offset.
Sorry, what is ICAO?
ICAO is the International Civil Aviation Organization. So one could actually just Google their carbon calculator, and you could work out what your carbon footprint for a particular flight is. And you don't really need an airline to be involved in this transaction. You could literally go online and look for a gold standard scheme, or where there are various carbon offset schemes, and you could literally offset your own carbon emissions without an airline being involved. So, I mean, as much as airlines are now actively doing this, one, there has to be a certain amount of education the world over, especially in the Asia-Pacific region where aviation is booming. And, you know, ticket prices are so low that sometimes, especially in the likes of countries like India, where, you know, sometimes tickets are sold below cost. So there has to be customer education. And I mean, for an airline in this region to be able to, which is already, I mean, not making a lot of money. So for them to be able to put aside money to become carbon neutral becomes really difficult. So So there is obviously a cost aspect to it, and it's incredible. And I mean, you know, credit must be given to airlines like Qantas and airlines in the West, which do make a fair amount of money to be able to actively put aside money for carbon offsetting.
The second issue we want to talk to you about, Vinamra, is British Airways are to investigate the practice of fuel tankering at the airline. Tankering, crudely, is filling planes up with fuel in low-cost environments and using that fuel to fly from high-cost jurisdictions later to save money. Mm-hmm. But the planes emit carbon in the process of just carrying that surplus fuel from A to B. BBC Panorama says BA's planes generated an extra 18,000 tonnes of carbon dioxide last year through fuel tankering. How widespread is this practice?
Well, I'll be honest with you. You know, this is pretty widespread. Across the world, there are low cost regimes where fuel is cheaper, and a lot of airlines do this. I mean, it's a common business practice, and it's just something that, you know, airline planners take into account when, for example, a route is launched. So, you know, ultimately it comes down to route economics. And if you're flying to a country or a jurisdiction where fuel is cheaper, it obviously does help start that flight in the first place. And then if you can bring back a certain amount of fuel, it helps network profitability, because at the end of the day, airlines are there to sort of, you know, turn a profit.
But I guess the average Joe public is going to say, well, yes, okay, have fuel by all means to carry passengers, to carry cargo, but to carry fuel for future use, that is unnecessary carbon emission.
So I'll be honest with you, Malcolm, you know, at the end of the day, it will all come down. Customers will sort of have to pay for this in some sort of way or the other. So, you know, there will be an impact on ticket prices if we've got to go in this direction of, you know, being sustainable. So, and are we at that stage where customers will willingly pay a premium to offset their carbon footprint? I don't think so. Are we getting there?
It's a very interesting question, Vinamra. We have to leave it there. This is not illegal, just not a sensible green practice. Thank you so much, Vinamra Longani, Head of Operations at the aviation-related law firm Sarin & Co. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed for listening. We're back live on air tomorrow morning from 6 a.m. with the Business Breakfast Breakfast.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.